In 1978, in celebration of my 6th birthday, I was taken to see Star Wars. For a boy born and raised all his young life in Yorkshire, still then a land of flat caps and deep coal mines, this was a momentous occasion. When we arrived, though, to my horror, the queue snaked back far along the road, and snakes twisted in my stomach too. But I sealed my lips to stop them getting out, raising a quiet prayer, I suppose, wanting things to be okay. They were. To my great relief, we got in, and for those 2 hours I sat back in that dark theatre and flew. I'd never been on a plane. Couldn't have told you if there was an airport within 200 miles. But that afternoon at the cinema, I flew weightless, hardly touching my seat as spaceships darted and rolled, without care for gravity. I can still picture that afternoon. Our souls are stuck fast to the ground. So first memories of flight imprint deeply, as they did for poet John Gillespie Magee, a pilot in the Canadian Air Force in World War II, aged just 19.
Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed, and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds, and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along, and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air, up, up the long, delirious, burning blue. I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace, where never lark nor even eagle flew. And while with silent, lifting mind I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God.
From what I've seen, you're magnificent. You fight evil with all you do. Your every hand is spectacular. Makes me lay here and love you.
That untrespassed sanctity of space, that was something I desperately sought. My sister was very ill, and the doctors were very worried, and my brother was being bullied because of our dad's job. He was a strong man, but he was also the local vicar. So while other people's dads sweated in pits underground, or wrestled animals on surrounding farms, for work he wore a dress. My mum wore dresses too. And sometimes she'd pop out to see a neighbour, and that twisted my stomach again, because even though I was only 6, the whole playground hummed with talk about women in nearby Yorkshire towns going missing, then being found, their clothes all torn by a man they called the Ripper. So I was a boy full of worries, and I wanted to fly. We don't realise it till later, perhaps, but a childhood can weigh a great deal. And as we grow, we wait for something strong enough to lift us away. A kiss, perhaps, or a first embrace.
A childhood explodes, scattering all toys, and it smashes through walls with a beautiful noise. There was the first boy that I knew.
For Jacques Brel, that song of his sung by Ellie Stone, it was love that took him, a girl that broke the heavy burden of his childhood. He was different from me. I was only six and, well, Princess Lear was taken. No, my first attempts at takeoff were via a new pair of trainers. They had a sponge wedge in each heel, a technology I thought so sophisticated, I had no doubt I'd jump right over the moon. And I remember returning from Star Wars and leaping from the back door, Billy Elliot long before Billy Elliot, springing around the garden, arms outstretched like an X-wing. Outer space, I quickly found, was beyond my reach. So, like my father, I turned inwards instead, his church becoming an inescapable part of my weekly rhythm. Religions have always functioned as spiritual elevators, and this is what those lamp-lit subterranean miners surfaced for each Sunday, a vision of a higher, lighter place, one I'd often heard described in a passage right at the end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation.
I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also there was no more sea. Then I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away.
No more pain when the old has passed away. At the bottom of our garden was the graveyard, and my brother and sister and I would peer at the funeral processions that took place there, the passing away ceremonies. They often seemed painful. Death may be medically described as flatlining, but it is flat in no other way. It travels along a vector perpendicular to the earth and almost always downwards. It is the fall from a great height, the ultimate letdown, all of us ending up boxed up, being lowered into the clay. That clay, I had been taught, was what our bodies were moulded from. But we were told in Sunday school that we were more than that. We had the breath of God too, they said. And it was that divine air, that flying spark of consciousness that pulled us towards high-minded morals and high ideas. If down was the body, was death and dust and decay, then the opposite must surely be true. Everything about up must be a move towards the immortal, towards the pure, towards God. This has been held true for thousands of years. Shamans, priests, visionaries, all talking of some ancient fall we long to recover from. But to go there, to ascend with our fallen bodies, this was beyond what was natural, was seen as an act of divine trespass, as Julian Barnes describes in Levels of Life.
The National Gallery in London owns an altarpiece by Benozzo Gozzoli. Its predella has been broken up and dispersed over the centuries. One section illustrates the story of St. Peter, Simon Magus, and the Emperor Nero. Simon was a magician who had won Nero's favour, and sought to keep it by proving that his powers were greater than those of the apostles Peter and Paul. This tiny painting tells the story in three parts. In the background is a wooden tower from which Simon Magus is demonstrating his latest trick, human flight. Vertical takeoff and lift have been achieved, and the Roman astronaut is seen heading skywards with only the bottom half of his green mantle showing, the rest is cut off by the picture's top edge. Simon's secret rocket fuel is, however, illegitimate. He relies, physically as well as spiritually, on the support of demons. In the midground, St. Peter is shown praying to God, asking him to dispossess the demons of their power. The theological and aeronautical results of this intervention are confirmed in the foreground. A dead magician, blood oozing from his mouth after an enforced crash landing. The sin of height is punished.
Gozzoli was painting in the 15th century, fully 300 years before we finally did achieve flight aboard Etienne Montgolfier's balloon on the 15th of October, 1783. Though it took until 1903 for the Wright brothers to perfect the first true aeroplane, things raced on from there. Less than 45 more years to reach supersonic flight, and only 14 more until Yuri Gagarin entered celestial space. The sin of height was no longer punished. Quite the opposite, in fact. We entered the heavens and found no force to judge us other than gravity. This would have been a surprise to many. Johannes Kepler, the man who discovered the laws of planetary motion, was convinced that the Garden of Eden would be found on the moon, the only place high enough to have escaped the biblical flood. He predicted that if we could only reach the lunar surface, we would be freed from war and violent divisions that tore humanity apart, lifting our clay bodies so far from the earth that they would be as sanctified as our heavenly minds. I wonder then, is this what all our struggles for height are about? A desperation to avoid the fall, our war against gravity, in truth a battle to prevent our descent back into the earth, our recapture by the clay that formed us? Kepler was proved wrong, of course. Eden wasn't on the moon. The space race was driven by the Cold War. And far from bringing peace, as Armstrong and Aldrin looked down from the lunar surface, the violence in Vietnam raged on far below them. Every pilot, every astronaut, every bird eventually falls. Our task cannot be to escape, but as the terminally ill Clive James described in a recent poem, to find a way of being reconciled to our inevitable descent.
Your death, near now, is of an easy sort. So slow a fading out brings no real pain. Breath growing short is just uncomfortable. You feel the drain of energy, but thought and sight remain. Enhanced, in fact. When did you ever see so much sweet beauty as when fine rain falls on that small tree and saturates your brick-back garden walls, so many amber rooms and mirror halls? Ever more lavish as the dusk descends, this glistening illuminates the air. It never ends. Whenever the rain comes, it will be there, beyond my time. But now I take my share. My daughter's choice, the maple tree, is new. Come autumn and its leaves will turn to flame. What I must do is live to see that. That will end the game for me, though life continues all the same. Filling the double doors to bathe my eyes, a final flood of colours will live on. As my mind dies, burned by my vision of a world that shone so brightly at the last, and then was gone.
Que lejos estoy del suelo donde nacieron. Intensa nostalgia invadir.
Is that the end of the game? Are we just dust that rises and gathers for a while and then falls and crumbles? Our quest for Eden has taken us so far, making use of flint and iron and steel to soar so high and lift ourselves to other heavenly bodies. But we found no gods there, no paradise, and still we all fall, all of us eventually tumbling and breaking up. Does that leave us no option but despair? Is there no one who can save us? Nothing that we can do? I spoke to Simon Critchley, professor of philosophy at New York's New School, who has written extensively on death, disappointment, and the afterlife. We began talking about Montaigne, the 16th century essayist who wrote that to philosophize is to learn how to die. And I asked Simon whether philosophy could somehow help us to live with our disappointments.
Yes, in the case of Montaigne, very, very clearly, you know, in a sense that there isn't a god in the form of some transcendent guy with a beard who's going to save us, and neither does God take the form of an iPhone.
So what does that mean? How do we do that?
the task is releasing us from those attachments in order to focus on something else, the fact of our mortality, and the fact of our mortality not as a source of woe, but as the thing that makes a human life a human life. For me, a more interesting or a braver, courageous human life is one which takes death into it and embraces it. That's what Montaigne meant. That's what Socrates meant when he described the philosopher as someone who's half dead.
But then what? How does one live when one has learnt how to die?
One lives well. The problem with the standard philosophical view, if you like, in Socrates and the Stoics and Montaigne, these people, is that the idea that to philosophize is to learn how to die, and to learn how to die is to learn how to live, is still, for me, too selfish an approach. It becomes about whether Socrates can die well or Seneca can die well. And it seems to me that the other aspect of human experience that needs to be added to that is the question of love. Love is that counter-movement to selfishness, which demands a huge amount of us. In relationship to the more kind of religious side to this, and my interests here are really drawing on mysticism, particularly Christian mysticism, is the idea of dying to the self. The self, it's a thing that we have, a kind of carapace that we assume over time because of language, culture, circumstances, and we have to tear that down. This is the process that Simone Weil called decreation, this wonderful idea of decreation, that we have to undo what is creaturely in us, what is given in us, in order to love.
Is that then perhaps a way that we can recover and reclaim this idea of resurrection? That after this death, we are somehow lifted again?
I believe in the afterlife insofar as I believe in the life of those that come after. And those that come after most closely, kids or people that you love or people that you've been close to, you want them to go on. So to a very large extent, there has to be an afterlife, and we believe in an afterlife. Not an afterlife of the soul's immortality, but an afterlife of those who will continue, who will go on.
Going back to Simone Weil and her book Gravity and Grace, if gravity is what brings the fall, perhaps grace is another word for that idea of love, that thing that lifts us once we've embraced that death?
Yeah, I mean, the question of flight and gravity is very important in the sense in which, you know, I begin from the idea that we're stuck to ourselves, we're kind of glued to ourselves, and flight, for me, is flight from that. And it seems to me that both the desire for flight, I mean, actual flight, or the desire to be kind of lifted up through an experience of grace are symptoms of that overwhelming desire that we have to become something else. So love has become flattened out and emptied, and we've got no real clue what it even means anymore. And that's where I think we have to draw on the spiritual traditions that are available to us, because if we reject those by saying, well, they're based on these metaphysical presuppositions like the existence of God, immortality of the soul, we don't believe any of that nonsense because, you know, we're far too clever. The problem is that we throw the baby out with the bathwater and we lose the real richness of those traditions, which is the experience of being with others in a loving way. The important thing is the act. Love is that movement in, let's say, the soul, the movement in who we are that looks outwards and upwards. And that's, I think that's something which is just harder and harder to sustain in all of the kind of white noise of culture that we inhabit.
Feel
The important thing is to act. In the interplay between gravity and grace, the most human response is not flight to some distant hoped-for Eden above, nor to fall to the ground in hopeless despair. To love is to look outwards from the self, upwards from the ground, even though we know it will, at some unknown time, break us down and take us back into itself. It is to believe absolutely in the afterlife, to fund as richly as possible those who will go on when we have gone on. This, heartbreakingly, is Clive James' task now, his poems and presence enriching this afterlife that he knows is coming, leaving those who must go on with a final flood of colours, a glistening that illuminates the air even as his dusk descends. I know something of that. 2 years ago, my closest friend died of cancer. He was 42. A wife, young twins, and so many others now part of his afterlife. An artist, a courageous thinker, like me, the son of a preacher man, he left great riches, not least in some of the reflections he wrote as he contemplated his own end, his own graceful submission to gravity. Cancer is vicious. Its reach is long. It stretches way beyond the limits of body.
Its reach is long. It stretches way beyond the limits of body, beyond the firewall of the skin. I want to see my kids grow up. I want to go grey with my wife. But sadly, this is not to be. Our lives have coincided for such a short time, and it's painful to imagine separation. But we cannot sustain the illusion of our self-sufficiency. We are all subject to decay, old age and death, to disappointment, loss and disease. We are all engaged in a futile struggle to maintain ourselves in our own image. These crises in our lives inevitably reveal how impossible our attempts to control our destinies really are. Tumours and treatments have exiled me from my previous life. How does one make sense of fuzzy images and blood counts? It's very hard to own an unseen malignant force, especially one that silently reproduces deep inside. Super-adaptive and autoimmune, these renegade cells seek immortality, but inevitably they will destroy the very system that sustains them. As with all buried psychic material, I've sought simply to become aware of them, to somehow make sense of their actions. We all have a contract with finitude. We all share the same destiny. Hard as it seems, we have to acknowledge that each one of us at the table will eventually become part of the meal. I've been broken and stripped bare. Cancer takes so much, it's utterly ruthless. But there are some things it cannot touch. It can't take how you feel about someone. Can't alter what's already been written.
It can't take back the irrevocable bonds of love. Some things cannot be stolen. Some things cannot be stolen. Words written in bold strokes of paint on one of the last pieces he created. Our bodies are taken. Our looks and sharp minds are looted. Our friends, our parents, sometimes even our children too. But as all of this is wrenched away and inevitably falls to the earth, one thing cannot be taken from us, not by gravity nor any other force in the universe. Against the dust of the planet, love endures into the afterlife, still takes the wing and lifts us, perhaps even beyond death. Perhaps.
Maybe there is a God above, but all I've ever learned from love was how to shoot somebody who outdrew you. And it's not a cry that you hear at night,
It's not somebody who's seen the light. It's a cold and it's a broken. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.